CliffCentral.com. Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com.
You're back on Cliff Central, listening to the Daily Maverick Show. My name's Greg Nicholson, filling in for Kingsley Kapoori today, our regular host. I'm joined in studio by Fatima Matiba, my colleague, intern, and fantastic young writer. Fatima, how are you doing?
I'm good, and you, Greg?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for coming in today. We finally got you on air.
Yeah. Yeah.
Reluctantly, you can tell. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about a few different issues. First, we're going to touch on the COSATU Special National Congress. What is going on with COSATU? What will be the future of the Federation of Trade Unions, and what will it mean for South African politics? We're going to be joined on the line by Daily Maverick journalist Ranjini Munasamy in just a moment. But Fatima, have you been following the story?
No, I haven't, not really.
Let's find out from Ranjini what's going on. Are you with us, Ranjini?
Yes, hello, Greg.
Ranjini, can you sort of paint us a picture of, before this Special National Congress for COSATU, what was on the line? What was happening?
Okay, well, this COSATU Special National Congress was requested by nine affiliates of COSATU prior to LIMSA's expulsion. So they wanted this Congress to discuss basically the paralysis in COSATU, the failures of leadership to implement the resolutions of the 2012 Congress. And basically that COSATU has been wrecked by divisions and national battles. So that's why they had requested it. But this was back in 2013. So it took a long while to actually get the Congress convened. And the COSATU president was talking here just now saying that, this Congress was actually quite unaffordable for them because they had not even budgeted for it, so they had to rely on sponsors to actually hold it. But, now that it's not actually clear what that purpose is. So NUMSA was the driving force behind this Congress, but they're not allowed to attend. Mm-hmm. And since the time of the request for the Congress to now, there have been dramatic developments in COSATU, as you know, the expulsion of NUMSA and the expulsion of the General Secretary, Zwelinde Mavhavhi. So people who unions who are allied to them and have been supporting them have wanted that issue of the expulsion to be discussed by Congress. But the COSATU president and the faction around him were adamant that could not be done. So yesterday, the first day of the Congress was actually quite a bizarre day in the history of COSATU, because, I've attended lots of these, you have as well. And, COSATU is quite a transparent organization because it's worker-based. They don't really do things behind closed doors. Out of all the alliance partners, they have been the most transparent. But quite strangely, yesterday morning, they asked the media to leave. They closed doors. They were actually quite hostile. There's high security presence because they didn't want anybody else to be privy to what was going on. And there were intense battles that raged. So after 10 p.m. last night, and the issues that they were debating were issues like the credentials, so who actually can attend this Congress. Mm-hmm. The faction allied to NUMSA and Tuvabi did not want this new metal workers union called LIMUSA to be present. And they also objected to the presence of the second deputy president of COSATU, Zingiswa Losi. So that's why, can you believe, it raged for about 8 hours yesterday. And so only late last night did they vote on it, and basically the dominant faction won that battle. So
the dominant faction being aligned to the president.
Dlamini, yep. Yeah. They won that battle. They won by quite a large number. But there were over 200 abstentions in that vote, a small number, just over 200, who voted against their presence. So that voting process actually revealed the balance of forces here at this Congress. That basically the faction allied to NUMSA and Barbie are greatly outnumbered. Mm. And that is basically because NUMSA is not allowed to attend, because remember that they were the biggest union in COSATU. So had they been here, they would have been closer voting numbers. But they're outnumbered. But I must say that even though that faction is outnumbered, they are speaking up, they are giving the other faction quite a run, you know, for the Congress to be held up for that long yesterday. Mm-hmm. You know, it just shows that they will not surrender easily.
Mm-hmm. Now, we were wondering before this Special National Congress whether it might be disrupted by other NUMSA supporters protesting outside or NUMSA's allies inside the hall sort of demonstrating there. Have we seen the Congress be disrupted at all? I know the media weren't happy and had their own little social media protest about being locked out, but have we seen any of the delegates or unionists outside protesting?
No, not at all. NUMSA was debating whether they will protest here. But it seems that they decided not to. And in truth, they don't need to because they are basically, you know, you can feel their presence in the room even though they're not here. Mm. They seem that they have lobbied extensively among their allies to be able to speak on their behalf. But as things stand, they remain out. They remain outside. They're not protesting here. But their allies continue to make points on their behalf. Yes, the media was quite upset. You know, you have some journalists throwing hissy fits at things, and understandably so. You know, you had to do a job. This is a major event. It has major repercussions for COSATU, for labor in South Africa, for leftist politics, and for the alliance. So it's a major event, and you know it's extremely disturbing that there's hostility against journalists, and that you know that COSATU is now trying to prevent information from coming out.
Mm. Now, last night, COSATU President Stuma Dlamini said that what's happened so far is a win for COSATU, but it seems like it's a win for his faction at the moment. Would you agree?
Yes, well, the numbers count in his side, so it is a win. But I think he would be extremely worried that, you know, from 11 o'clock yesterday morning till 10 o'clock last night, he was battling to keep a grip on the Congress, even though the numbers are in his favor. It shows that, you know, he can't easily exercise his authority as president. And I think that the problem for him also is that while the numbers are in his favor, you know, there is splintering and divisions in individual unions, even those allied to him. And one point is that the NUMSA allies were trying to argue strongly yesterday for a vote by secret ballot because they felt that a show of hands because you know members who have differing views from their leadership would not be able to express it openly because, you know, they would be defying the mandate. But there clearly are differences of views, and they wanted to create an atmosphere where those views could be expressed and could be reflected.
Mm-hmm.
But the leadership insisted on a show of hands because then, you know, people have to vote in blocks, basically. Mm-hmm. And that did count in the favor of the dominant faction.
For a long time, it seems like NUMSA and Zwelin Zimavavi have been trying to push for as many avenues they can to try and keep COSATU together for as long as possible before perhaps forming some sort of other federation of trade unions or pushing with a workers' party. Do you think COSATU, after this, will be able to avoid a complete fracture?
I don't know. That's difficult to say. Right now, the discussion has just begun on a discussion document on unity and cohesion. I think that NUMSA has been worried about going too much out on a limb without being able to carry its allies with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been reflected in the United Front. They did take a risk by forming the United Front, but the problem for them is that they didn't carry those eight other unions which have been acting with them. They didn't carry them onto the United Front. Those unions, most of their members, still support the ANC and still may want to remain in COSATU if they're able to, you know, get COSATU to act more in a democratic fashion. So, you know, by the end of this this special Congress, by tonight, hopefully, you know, there will be some kind of indication of where COSATU is heading, whether it is able to unite its divergent forces, or whether the rebel unions will feel that they no longer belong here, that they're not getting a fair hearing, that they no longer have confidence in the leadership. And so then you may see that, you know, NUMSA would be then bold enough to go it alone and form an alternate federation.
And it'll also be interesting to see how these sort of rebel unions respond to the heavy-handed tactics and the secrecy being implemented by the Kasatu leadership right now. But Ranjini,
yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Look, you know, the thing is that I think that after the vote yesterday, things have settled down a lot because I think now everybody in this room knows what the numbers are. Mm-hmm. So I don't, you know, yesterday they were much more emboldened because they didn't know. They thought that they had a lot more support than they did, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that so far they're acting in blocks. But we'll have to hear how the discussions go now, because they're now open discussions. They cut out the commission, so it's all going to happen here on the floor today. We'll just have to monitor and see what happens.
Mm. Ranjini, we saw earlier today the Speaker of the National Assembly and ANC National Chairperson Bleka Mbete address the Special National Congress. Did she express any fear from the ANC side at what sort of impact this division could have on the ANC's election chances?
Well, obviously, the ANC has a vested interest in Kasatu remaining united and remaining in the alliance because they need the workers to basically remain, marching in line with the ANC's vision and ANC's program of action. I think the rebellion in Kasatu has negatively affected the ANC. We have seen, I don't think they want anybody else to follow Nusa on the way out, because Nusa withdrew their electoral support for the ANC formally. They also withdrew funding for the ANC, and I think that they cannot afford that kind of messaging to go out any longer. She was speaking very strongly in favor of Kasatu uniting, mm-hmm. and dealing with this division, and being able to have debates in a disciplined and mature fashion, is the way she put it.
Mm-hmm. But it seems the ANC is quite wary about pushing too strongly for Nomsa or Vavi to come back within Kasatu, because they don't want to take away the federation's sovereignty, perhaps.
Yes, look, I think they're two schools of thought in ANC. I think there's some people in the ANC leadership who believe that they can pull it back, that, you know, they can pull Nomsa and Vavi back. But others feel that, you know, that they have been troublemakers. They have been campaigning against the ANC for a long time. So perhaps, you know, they should go their own way. That's why I think there is a caution from the ANC that, you know, there was a time when they were urging people to set aside distance and trying to heal the divisions. But now I think that they're just trying to consolidate the unions who remain in Kasatu and keep them on side.
Mm-hmm. We saw recently, I think it was last week, or the week before last week, there was a tripartite alliance summit, you know, with the SACP, Kasatu and the ANC coming together. Could this Special National Congress for Kasatu help really unite the alliance in terms of pushing for the future elections and perhaps rectifying some of their past wrongs? Or?
Well, again, the Kasatu president, in his address, spoke very strongly about that alliance outcome. He said that it was a powerful summit. He set the line of march. I think Nomsa had campaigned very strongly for the, you know, a withdrawal from the alliance, saying that there was no longer a reason for the unions to remain in alliance with the ANC, because they get nothing out of that relationship. And basically the workers just serve as voting cattle for the ANC. There's quite a strong counter-argument coming from the Kasatu leadership now, saying it is important that we remain in the alliance, the ANC is still, the best way for workers' interests to be advanced, and basically trying to argue that the views of Kasatu is still being respected, even though there is a general acknowledgement that Kasatu failed to convince the ANC to change its position, for example, on e-tolls.
And after this Congress, considering it looks like Vavi and Nomsa definitely won't help them be reinstated within Kasatu, where do you see the future for Nomsa and Vavi? Because now this leaves them in a bit of it's sort of a crossroads for them.
Yeah, at a media briefing on Sunday, the Nomsa Deputy General Secretary was basically saying this is like the last round of battle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if they can't win, I don't think they're going to wait till November to still appeal their case. I think that they're going to go their own way now. they have resources. They've been lobbying extensively. They've been traveling to other parts of the world to basically get support for a new leftist movement. So they have a lot of balls in the air. They have the United Front, which is a collection of social movements or social organizations, and they want to start an alternative federation. And they also have a resolution to pursue forming a new leftist workers' party.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know what exactly Bobby's role will be in all of that, but I think that would be now, that they're able to gauge on the outcome of this Kusatu Special National Congress, where everyone stands, and what exactly it would make sense for them to pursue now.
Mm-hmm. And do you get a sense from the Kusatu National Congress now that there is a concern for workers? Because it seems with all this division that the workers and their issues have been forgotten.
Well, there's a lot of focus on the organizational aspect. Mm. There was a little talk, for example, on Marikana.
Okay.
And an attack on Lonmin, basically, from the Kusatu president saying, you know, that they were just pursuing profits and didn't act in the interest of workers and things. But it was just basically, you know, a throwaway part of his speech, not the main focus. But yes, this is a big problem that, you know, there is no sort of nuts and bolts issues on worker issues being discussed, and issues such as that, you know, poverty and the plight of workers, the cost of living, the battles of workers on the shop floor. Those issues are not up for discussion. It's more about organizational issues and the state of Kusatu at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Ranjini, I think we'll leave it there. I'm sure you have to get back to the Congress.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks very
Enjoy
much.
Enjoy the rest of the show.
Thank you. That was Ranjini Munasamy, Daily Maverick journalist at the Kusatu Special National Congress, looking at issues of Kusatu's division and what's going to happen to the Alliance and the National Union of Metal Workers, as well as the former Kusatu General Secretary Zewelyn Zimavavi after this, and it doesn't look good for them. But I'm joined in studio with a Daily Maverick intern, journalist, young writer, Fatima Matiba. And Fatima, we're talking outside a little bit about an article you wrote recently.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at issues of going from, I suppose, the university space into the workplace, and some of the challenges that even if you have a degree or even if you are, you know, you're reasonably qualified and things like that, when you go into the workplace, one of the key ways you go in there is, or get your foot in the door, is, of course, through internships.
Yeah.
And you wrote a piece talking about how, as an intern, a lot of the intern positions available are actually unpaid.
Yes.
Making it extremely difficult. Can you just elaborate on some of these challenges and what you've seen in your own experience?
Well, I think my experience was a lot easier than a lot of other people's experiences, just because I have parents that can afford to support me. So I'm in a 6-month internship, and it's unpaid, and so I need to be supported for 6 months. Someone needs to pay for my transport and my food and stuff. And I found that a lot of people that I was working with had a tougher time than I did. Because their parents had a lot more difficulties providing the things that they needed to give the other interns for 6 months. So, yeah, I just feel like being an unpaid intern, depending on your background, varies, and it's mm-hmm. a lot more difficult for people to do it.
Mm-hmm. What are some of those challenges that you've seen your friends face? So you said their parents might come from more, they might have more difficulties that they face. What are some of those things that might make it more difficult to even just get your foot in the door in a workplace and do an internship?
So I found that a lot of the interns that actually have qualifications and degrees are expected to immediately go into the workplace and earn a salary, and their parents continually put pressure on them to leave the internship.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, they feel like their lack of experience holds them back from getting these jobs. So they're kind of caught in a very awkward position. A lot of the interns struggle with transport. We know what a nightmare transport in South Africa in general is like.
So if you're in Johannesburg and perhaps you live in Diepkloof or something in Soweto and you need to get to work, you know, there and back every day, a taxi is what, like 15 rand each way or something?
Exactly.
That's if you live in town. Maybe if you're going to Sandton, it's more. So you might be spending, you know, at least 50 rand or something a day just on public transport.
Yeah. And we often find that when it comes to the working hours, a lot of the interns have difficulties working things that run later on into the night because of safety and getting access to public transport late at night. So if you don't have a car, it's also quite difficult to do an internship.
So in your experience and for yourself and some of your friends, have you found that it is still valuable to do one of these unpaid internships? I guess it's sometimes the only way that you're going to get into the get some experience in the workplace.
I think sometimes you just have to bite the bullet and do it if you want experience and if you're really keen on getting into the industry. But I also do think that you need to be sure that it's what you want to do, because it is a tough process. So only do it if you're sure you really want to get into that industry and you want to pursue that career.
Is it frustrating for perhaps yourself? You're a young graduate, you know, you're academically very qualified, and then you have to come on, and obviously you've got skills to bring, considering just the schooling that you've been through, you know, which you've done a lot of. Is it frustrating then to have to go and say, oh, I have to sign up for 6 months unpaid, and my parents are going to be out of pocket trying to pay for some things like transport?
I think for me, I've begun to realize that no matter how qualified I am, I'm going to have to start at the bottom. And if I have to do it for 6 months, I'm more than willing to do it. And I'm lucky enough that I actually can do that. So I think a lot of people assume that people my age think that if they have a certain level of education, then they'll want to immediately jump into a career that's a job that's not an entry-level job. I think that's not true.
You have to do the time.
Yeah.
But surely employers must step up and try and offer some sort of stipend or some sort of at least pay expenses and things like that, no?
I definitely do think that given the history of our country and the positions that a lot of people that are young and black find themselves in, that companies do have to do that. If they really want to benefit the country and affect this youth unemployment, then they actually have to do that. Yeah.
I've seen in certain cases with some interns where if companies don't at least pay expenses or pay some sort of stipend, what you end up getting is almost a cycle of a repeated cycle of the inequalities we already have in our country, because the people who can get to work, the people who can afford perhaps their cell phone expenses or have internet at home, are the ones who already have money.
I agree. Yeah. I definitely, when I look at my situation, I find that, for example, I can go report on an event that's late at night, and then I
produce. Because you've got a car.
Yeah, because I've got a car and I can drive around late at night. And then I end up producing one extra article and it looks like I'm working harder, but really I just have a car so I could go to that event.
You've just got more access than a lot of other people do.
Exactly.
I think it's a really interesting situation that a lot of employers have to confront, and it's not an easy position to be in as a young person just trying to get into the workplace, even getting into professional jobs. I think it's a really quite a struggle that we have to look at. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. My name's Greg Nicholson, filling in for Kingsley Kapoori. I'm joined with Daily Maverick colleague and contributor for Tima Mativa. Soon we're going to be jumping to looking at a case in the Western Cape High Court, where last week Judge Siraj Desai declared that garnishee orders or deductions taken from employees' salaries were illegal. Fatima, you followed this case a little bit.
Yeah, I did.
Okay, and what did you think?
I thought it was really interesting. I did know about garnishee orders briefly, a little bit. I wasn't too schooled on the topic. But I really think that this is an interesting case.
And just for everyone else out there, garnishee orders basically, or I think it's emolument attachment orders, essentially are when if you owe some, if you're in debt and you're not paying your debt and you have a creditor or something, that creditor can go and apply to the courts, and through that they can get a court order that will mean that from your paycheck, your employer will deduct a certain amount, and that will go towards paying that debt off. But we've seen widespread abuse of this practice, and often if you have a low wage, it ends up meaning that you have a much, much lower wage because, you know, a lot of your money is going to pay whatever this debt is that you may not have paid off. And so in a moment, So right now, I think we're joined by the University of Stellenbosch's Matilda Ross-Lee, coordinator of the Financial Literacy Project for their legal aid clinic. And Matilda was involved in the case that I'm talking about in Western Cape. Matilda, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hey, thanks for joining us. First of all, can you just tell us about how did this case start? Because it actually sounds like quite a groundbreaking case. Where did it come from, and how did it end up with you guys?
Well, we have been working with debt-related matters for a very long time, since mm-hmm. we opened the university. So basically, the Legal Aid Clinic has two functions. The one is we train law students, and the other one is we provide legal assistance, free legal assistance to the vulnerable people in the community. And from the day that we opened our office's doors, we have been dealing with unlawful judgments or emolument attachment orders. I started here in 2006. Mm-hmm. And then that was when the debt review program was implemented to see how it will transpire when the National Credit Act, you know, will be put in place, especially in terms of Section 86. Yes. So when I started here, I saw that there was a huge problem with reckless credit provision, and then the emolument attachment orders was the only way, or the only, in most cases, a security for the creditors to get their capital back.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been working with this since 2006, it was difficult. We couldn't approach, we couldn't do then what we did now because of Mrs. Wendy Appelbaum, who came, you know, on board, and one of the emolument attachment orders was, you know, served on them for one of her employees, and by that time she has read in the newspapers what we've done so far, and that's how I understand it, and she wanted to make an appointment to see whether we can address this situation on a big scale. Through class action, but since I'm so busy with, I'm so busy doing the groundwork that in order to get all this information together to do the research for a case like this, I didn't foresee that we will be able to do that, mm-hmm. but she insisted. She was the drive behind all this. So she did her own research. She got the attorney, she got our counsel, and she just used our case studies as examples.
Okay.
So
for our listeners, Wendy Appelbaum is a prolific businesswoman and philanthropist, yes. Well-known philanthropist. What was her motivation for coming to you? Was it that her workers, she thought it was dodgy, perhaps? What was going on?
Because her concern was that the specific employee, he mm-hmm. didn't know what the debt was about. It was debt that was seeded. I think in his case it was a furniture store that has seeded the debt to another collection agency.
Okay.
So on the court order, you will get a different name from the original creditor. And I could immediately see because I've been working with this kind of thing, I was sure that it was either, another creditor or, something, or a debt that has been seeded or sold to mm-hmm. debt collectors.
Mm-hmm.
So she, you know, that I think she used Summit, who investigated that further. But like I said, because there's such a concern with regards to farm workers, and that's the type of clientele, or not type, sorry, we deal mainly with farm workers and support staff at the residences here on campus, all over in the whole Wynland, Greater Wynland District. So because it impacted them so much more, she was keen that we, you know, use them as examples
mm-hmm.
of the problem that exists.
Okay, so one of Wendy Applebaum's workers, who I assume is a farm worker, am I right?
Yes.
Was getting deductions from his paycheck, and he didn't know what it was, and then they come to you. What happens next?
I told her at that stage. I told her I didn't know. I didn't know who she was, and I just thought she's one of a very concerned employer. I deal with concerned employers a lot, who refer cases to me, with concern about the employees' problems with debt collectors. And I told her, well, he can make an appointment with me, and we can open a file, we can investigate everything, and then see how it transpires. And I told her, you know what you can do? You can, if you can help, if you can just educate your farm workers about the procedure with regards to emoluments and such laws. Now I laugh about it when I think it back. But she was, because she wants to do so much more than just educational programs on the farm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But that's when this whole thing, the meeting started taking place. She arranged meetings with Weber Wenzel, our attorney, Odette Haldenais, and the council. And they have, you know, I wasn't involved with the meetings, but they put in a lot of work, many hours, to get the facts together, to go through all the cases, because we don't have just 15, you know, cases of about emoluments and attachment orders. From between 2010 and to date, I have 432 separate emoluments attachment order investigation.
Okay.
And that figure is based on every case, every emolument attachment order. If one client can have four or five. I had one client who had seven emolument attachments on his salary.
I can't imagine it would be taking much home after that.
But the problem with this specific case was, in my opinion, from my perspective, you know, you see there's a lot of emolument attachment orders that were unlawfully issued, or at the jurisdiction was incorrect, or what the matter might be. But the problem is the reckless credit provision. Because by the time that these clients were entering into credit agreements with SA Multiloan or one of the shelf companies, or, you know, but mainly SA Multiloan, mm-hmm. then by that time they were already over indebted.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit was granted according to the evidence I have, in the cases where the micro lender, SA Multiloan, was involved.
Mm-hmm.
That was the scenario. They were already over indebted due to other credit providers who issued credit recklessly, and that the sad story after the National Credit Act was implemented,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that was a big issue. So the Another thing is the people didn't have access to justice because the judgments were taken before judgments were taken in places far off, or in most of the cases, they signed documents without knowing what they were signing, or they thought they just signed a tenants register, you know, the agent who visited them, a tenants register. Because in some cases, the clients were adamant that they won't sign, and then the agent would tell them, just sign as proof that I have been with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, or that I told you, or that I came to see you, this is all, you know, it's the only reason why you sign. So some people have 4 or 5 immoral attachment orders against them, but they only signed one.
Mm-hmm.
So then, you know, you have to ask, when we ask for original documents about the debt, because in some cases the clients never entered into a credit agreement with SA Multiloan or with one of the JD Group, branches, mm-hmm. you know, any of the furniture stores. So then it's difficult because they would just attach an affidavit that would state that all the original documents was lost or burned in a fire or what the case might be. So it was really, really difficult mm-hmm. to get, in our case, where our clients can't afford legal service, to get a correspondent in a town far away where we don't have legal aid, you know, correspondence. So, so I'm so grateful and thankful for all those correspondents who have been willing to help us free of charge or on a pro bono basis
mm-hmm.
to assist us with these applicants' applications in courts all over.
And
so,
what did we hear in court, Matilda? We don't have too much time left. Can you tell me a bit of a wrap up as to what the eventual court order and the judgment entail? It sounded like it was quite scathing.
Well, we expected the impact, that's why we did it, and that's why we are overjoyed by the outcome. We are so relieved, and we're so glad for the sake of all our applicants, our clients, and all the debtors, in you know, all the consumers who have been bullied into these emolument attachment orders. And then we're humbled by the goodwill of Wendy Applebaum, Odette Haldenhuis, and our council.
Mm-hmm. And so for consumers across the country who might have emolument attachment orders against them, what might this case mean for them?
At the moment?
In the future, will
they have current emolument attachment orders.
Mm-hmm.
They have the right, in any event, to challenge the emolument attachment order, where it was issued. Was it issued in the court where they are residing or working? So it's not where the head office where they work is situated. It is where they are actually working.
Mm-hmm.
The court order must be issued in that jurisdiction. Also, was the court order issued by a clerk of the court or was there judicial oversight?
Mm-hmm.
And then if they have paid, you know, if they have paid and the court order was illegal, they have the right to actually claim any money that were collected in terms of that court order
mm-hmm.
To claim it back.
And how widespread do you think that these abuses on these orders are across the country?
Well, if I look at our examples, and this is not only since SA Multiloan or Flemix came, you know, surfaced. Way before that, or for a long time, it's only specific firms that's guilty of this, that's where they use you know, forum shopping or court way out of the reach of the debtors.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, if I look at our examples, it's quite huge.
Okay, Matilda, thank you so much for joining us today. That's all we have time for. That's Matilda Ross-Lee, coordinator of the Financial Literacy Project at the University of Stellenbosch's Legal Aid Clinic. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Cheers. Okay, you're with the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. Now, Fatima, one thing that I think the reason we wanted to bring this up is just because garnishee orders and emolument attachment orders are such a big issue across the country, and there are so many dodgy practices. There are so many dodgy practices going on that we really wanted to bring it up and talk about what's happening. And also, I don't know if you know this or a lot of people know this, but the credit problems with credit lending and unscrupulous lending and, you know, these sort of dodgy micro lenders and things like that,
yeah,
was even one of the key drivers behind the Marikana strikes in 2012. And it still exists, particularly in the mining areas. But consumers across the country face all of these issues. And many people find that they'll have deductions from their salary that they don't know what's going on, they don't know where it's going to, they don't know how long it's going to keep on happening for. And there are many cases. I know Summit Garnishee Solutions is one organization looking into this, and it's found huge amounts of money that has been taken off debtors, and it's actually been found out to be illegal. They're taking money when they shouldn't be taking money.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that we highlight that situation. And in a minute, we're going to go to Richard Poplack, Daily Maverick journalist, and to talk about the Tour de France. There's some exciting things over there. Richard, are you with us?
I am with you, sir.
How are you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad. So to finish off the show today, we're just going to talk to Richard a little bit about what's going on in the Tour de France. I think we're up to stage 10, aren't we, Richard?
Yes, stage 10 today. It was a rest day yesterday, and today is a very, very tricky stage.
Mm-hmm. We saw some pretty hard racing sort of throughout the first week of the Tour de France, but I think if you're looking at the event from here in South Africa, this real story has to be MTN Kubeka's rise and success.
100%. This is the first de facto African team that's been fielded and managed for the Tour de France, so it's really a monumental moment for the sport and a monumental for African cycling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody really understands that. There's been a fortune of media surrounding the MTN Kubeka guys over in France. Some of the images of them just crowded with photographers as they get off their bikes. In particular, Daniel Teklamont, the Eritrean cyclist. It's been enormously exciting, and I think everybody sort of understands how momentous this is for African cycling and for African sport.
Mm. And I think also just for the changing of the future of cycling, because traditionally if anyone follows cycling, everybody knows that the large majority of cycling and where it's, you know, the real heartland of cycling is around Europe, and, you know, it's particularly a white European sport, and all of a sudden this is starting to mix it up.
It's definitely a white European sport, but what I think a lot of us have forgotten is sort of the roots of the sport, and that is that it was a, you know, it sort of emerged from the sort of dust of the industrial age,
mm.
and it was very much a working class sport.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, rich folk just didn't get on bicycles. It was a sport that working class people took seriously and got involved in. There were all sorts of communist initiatives to unionize Tour de France cyclists in the early days. They called them the sort of slaves of the road. So there is this kind of link between what's happening with this whole Africa Rising narrative, sort of slowly industrializing African countries and emerging African working class, and this sort of idea of Africans getting on bicycles and starting to achieve great things.
Mm-hmm. The traditional story of these sort of, you hear all these myths about the great cyclists that came up and stories about them perhaps one day, you know, they're going home from, they're working at a young age or going home from school or something like that, and they'd race the school bus or,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
stories like that. And it really does seem to fit into the same sort of position that a lot of African countries face right now. You can imagine some school kids out there, you know, who, you know, their family doesn't have a car, they don't really afford public transport, but maybe they've got a bicycle. And that's one way that they can find, number one, freedom, and number two, just general transport.
Well, I certainly think that plays a role. But the amazing thing is when you look at the figures and Kubeka, the charity that MTN is affiliated with, and they're involved with bringing bringing bicycles, bringing homemade South African bicycles to children. When you look at the stats, there are almost no bicycles on the continent.
Mm.
Very, very, very few Africans get on bicycles. That's something that Quebec hopes to change. Mm-hmm. Once they have sort of made this cultural shift, what you're starting to look at is a whole bunch more Africans starting to ride bikes, and the pool sort of starting to widen. That being said, in countries where there are cycling cultures, Eritrea number one, South Africa number two, you're starting to see amazing results. Mm-hmm. Daniel Tekle-Hamos is currently in the King of the Mountains jersey at the Tour de France.
The first African rider to wear the jersey, right?
South African riders have worn the jersey. I mean, if you, in real terms, Chris Froome is a South African cyclist.
Okay.
I mean, he
mm-hmm.
did so much of his formative training here. What I find a bit insulting is that he doesn't credit this country with doing more for the establishment of his career, but that's his choice.
Yeah.
Yes, Daryl Impey has worn yellow.
Yeah.
There are other guys who had some real success in.
Robbie Hunt has worn the white jersey, has he?
Yep, correct, he has. So there's, South Africa has seen some success at the Tour and in the European circuit, but I think what MTN will do, especially with some of their more talented South African cyclists, is start building real GC or general classification contenders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How do you see, now we have Daniel Tekle-Hamos in the polka dot jersey, the King of the Mountains jersey. Do you think he'll be able to hold on to it through the mountains? Is he and these Eritreans, are they there yet in terms of their natural climbing ability?
It much more comes down to team tactics and mm-hmm. what Doug Ryder, who is the team manager, decides to do today. Today is a very, very big day. There's a massive climb at the end of the race. It's the only place that King of the Mountain points are available, and 30 points are up for grabs. So in other words, they have to keep him in contention to actually come close to winning the race. I mean, he has to be in the top five or six guys to claim at least some residual points from that climb in order to stay at the King of the Mountain jersey. So that means burning a whole bunch of matches to keep him up there in order to protect that jersey, and I'm not sure that's entirely worthwhile when they would probably like to see a stage win from Louis Meinke
mm-hmm.
later in the tour once they get into the Alps.
Mm-hmm.
So it really comes down to strategy. And as you know, Greg, cycling is an enormously strategic sport. So it comes down to what decisions Doug Ryder decides to make on the day. Armchair coaching, I would not throw all the matches at a day like today. You'd want to keep something in reserve and you'd want to hope for a stage win further down the line. So I think it's unlikely he'll hang on to the jersey, but I could be wrong.
Hmm. One thing I've noticed with this MTN Quebec story is that it seems to be a positive story that we can follow as cycling fans after many years of upsetting drug abuse stories. And it does seem to be a story that, you know, something new is happening. There's a new exciting frontier in cycling that we can sort of latch onto, forgetting some of the painful past.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of those rare positive stories that sort of the sport encounters every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak for the relative cleanliness or not of the MTN group. I think Doug Ryder's philosophy is that he'd like to keep the team clean. A lot of people start out by saying that. I think it's a great ethos to keep in mind. Greg, I never go on record saying that I think a team is clean.
Yeah.
I think dirty until proven otherwise.
Well, he's pretty sure, and that's the case.
Yeah, exactly. That said, we're in an era of much less doping than we were even 5 years ago, especially in a race like the Tour de France. The Giro less so, and the Volta d'Espagne, which is the other Grand Tour, the third Grand Tour of the year, I think is completely dirty.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in a race like this one, you're looking at about as clean as it gets in the professional circuit. So, yeah, you're right. It is sort of a good news story in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Now, in general, what have your highlights of the tour been so far? There's been some really exciting racing.
Yeah, there's been some fantastic racing. I mean, for me, the fact that Tekle-Hamos is in the polka dot jersey is a highlight. I think that team has raced enormously aggressive cycling. And I think it's been really, really gratifying to see. I think the stage four day, or the very, very, or, I think the stage three day, the very, very windy stage across the Zeeland in in Holland was just a reminder to cycling fans that even a relatively flat, harmless-looking course on the profile can be enormously dangerous,
mm-hmm.
And very, very tough racing once the wind gets involved.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that Tava effect, which I think was stage six, was very, very exciting. I think it's been an amazing tour. I think there's been some great racing, and I don't think cycling fans could ask for better.
No, I think it's incredible considering the amount of hard racing we've had so far, and we're only just getting into the mountains today, really.
Yeah, today we sort of nudge up against the first mountain stage,
mm-hmm.
and it's been I wouldn't want to be in the saddle with those guys. It's been a nightmare up the mountain, real, real racing. And you could see someone like Vincenzo Nibali, who really should be right up there with Chris Froome, is 2 minutes and 20 seconds back, which is enormously dangerous for him. There's been some real attrition. It's war up there.
Now, before we let you go, Richard, do you have a prediction for who might win the race? Is Chris Froome going to keep the yellow jersey?
Well, look, I actually have money on Alberto Contador.
Okay.
So I said I'm not willing to let that go yet.
Mm-hmm.
He raced and won the Giro d'Italia, 3 weeks in the Italian mountains. So he's on tired legs, but I think he'll race his way into fitness by the time he gets into the mountains. Like, he'll start feeling good today. So I still kind of feel good about Contador, but Froome and Team Sky look very, very strong. And I think if I take the money out of the equation, they're probably the best guys for the job.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's all we have time for today. Thanks, Richard, for the chat. Maybe we'll give you another call when the Tour de France is up.
Brilliant. Look forward to it.
Okay, cheers.
Ciao.
You're listening to Daily Maverick on Cliff Central. My name's Greg Nicholson, and that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much to my guest, Fatima Matiba, who's been in the studio.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
Also, Matilda Ross-Lee, coordinator of the Financial Literacy Project at the University of Stellenbosch's Legal Aid Clinic, and Ranjini Munasamy, Daily Maverick journalist. Download the podcast and subscribe, and tune in next week. Thank you.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays, 1 to 2 p.m. on CliffCentral.com. CliffCentral.com.